Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we talk to the director of the brand new film McFarland, USA. It stars Kevin Costner and tells the real-life story of the McFarland High School cross-country team, which set state records in the 1980s and 90s and is soon to captivate the nation. We'll also learn more about the future of the Fresno Grand Opera, which recently merged with Modesto's Townsend Opera. We'll learn about their new production of A Streetcar Named Desire and what's in store for the two companies. We'll also go to the World Ag Expo in Tulare and learn more about what's new in the world of agriculture at the biggest farm show on the globe. But first, we turn our attention to the world of criminal justice. With rising prison populations, exploding budgets, and a federal court order to reduce the number of people behind bars, sentencing reform has been a hot topic in California over the last few years. California voters voiced their approval of the concept last fall when they approved Proposition 47. But now, some are saying the benefits also come with some unintended consequences. FM 89's Diana Aguilera brings us this report.
When voters passed Proposition 47 in November, it reduced certain drug and property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Right away, county jails across the state started noticing a change. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mim says it's eased overcrowding.
It's reduced our jail population by about 300 inmates because now misdemeanors are being cited rather than booked into the county jail.
But the measure also created a problem. Fewer people are participating in drug court programs because now they're not required to. Local law enforcement authorities say it's dismantling the drug court system as we know it. Mims calls this the biggest unintended consequence of the new state law.
Pre-Prop 47, with some drug offenses being felonies, the district attorney's office could go to the offender and say, look, if you agree to go into and stay into this program, I will charge you with a misdemeanor. And that's how we got people into programs.
Mims is referring to drug court treatment programs. She says it all changed when Prop 47 passed.
Now there's no incentive for that same offender to go into the program.
The ballot measure changed everything from shoplifting to possession of small amounts of drugs, including cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamines, from felonies to misdemeanors. It's also affected people who were already charged and convicted. As of this month, there's been nearly 3,200 people in Fresno County who have petitioned to have their sentences reduced. Tensions between those who support Prop 47 and those who don't have grown tremendously. Supporters say they're fighting against mass incarceration and want to give people second chances without labeling them as felons. Those who are against it say the new law is bad for public safety and for the future of drug treatment programs. Fresno County's Chief Probation Officer Rick Chavez says they're already seeing the impact that it's having on drug court programs.
A lot of the offenders who were participating in drug courts as felons have had their cases reduced to misdemeanors and have decided that they no longer want to participate.
He fears these type of programs may be a thing of the past.
It's sort of, like I said, dismantled our drug court locally, sir. Certainly, we're at the point now we really don't have a working post-conviction drug court for these offenders.
But supporters of Prop 47 question the success rate of these programs and say reducing prison spending is their priority. The savings will go to K-12 schools, assistance for victims of crime, mental health, and drug treatment. Joey Williams with Faith in Action Kern County says it's also about encouraging people to succeed in life.
From the faith standpoint, our moral imperative is that, you know, we're all about second chances, and we believe that this was a way of getting some dignity back, as folks can now apply for jobs that they were locked out of before.
When it comes to drug treatment programs, Williams recognizes that it's going to be much harder for individuals to participate since now there's no obligation to do so.
No law or proposition is perfect, you know, and I don't think the intention of Proposition 47 was to weaken drug treatment programs.
Williams says their main goal was to help people.
But one thing that we can't have going on anymore is that individuals who get one of these felonies or being a felon for the rest of their life. And I think that was the real issue. And this is just kind of one of those collateral things that happen in the aftermath.
In Fresno County, Counselor Kelly Thompson has worked with people battling alcohol and drug abuse for nearly 20 years. He says most post-conviction drug court programs last about 18 months and consist of working with counselors along with checking up with a judge. Thompson thought there would be changes with Prop 47, but the way it's played out came as a surprise. He says it set out a chain reaction of dropouts.
I think a lot of the drug court scenarios, they didn't know that it would be that quick. I'm sure a lot of the case managers were pretty numbed by the domino effect.
When the measure passed in November, there were some people who were in these programs. They were given the choice to continue or to abandon it. Jeff Pitcock was one of them. He says he was one of the few that decided to pull through and graduate.
All the ones that were in my particular group bailed, you know, which is kind of a bummer. You know, because the difference between getting almost to the end and the end is huge.
Pitcock says he started using meth at age 19. He's now 53. And for the first time, he's been clean from drugs. I asked him if things would have been different if this new law was in effect when he initially decided to participate in drug court.
If you had just been arrested and what used to be your felony was now a misdemeanor, would have you personally completed the drug court programs?
If it was a misdemeanor, I wouldn't even broke a sweat on that. I really wouldn't have, because, you know, it's not a problem. The problem is felonies, and that's just from the aspect of when you got to put it on a job application. If you got a bunch of felonies, nobody's going to talk to you.
Pitcock says now that he's clean and no longer has a felony on his record, he's optimistic about finding a job. Post-Prop 47 offenders hope they'll have the same opportunity for a second chance. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Today, in Tulare County, the start of the world's largest outdoor farm expo. It's the World Ag Expo, and joining us now from the event is our own Ezra David Romero, who's going to be reporting on the activities this week at this show that's so vital to the agriculture industry in the Valley. Ezra, welcome.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Ezra, what are some of the things that you saw yesterday, which was Media Day? A lot of the media members from across the globe who come to the Valley to focus on what's new in the world of agriculture. What are some of the things that you saw yesterday at the show in the preview and that attendees are going to be looking at today?
Yeah, it seems like everyone's really excited about drones this year. I know drones are a hot topic, and so there's three or four different drone exhibitors, and one's located here in Exeter. And there's even one in this place called the Arena where they're going to, like, fly it around and basically move piles of dirt.
What exactly are they doing with these drones? How would farmers use them?
So a lot of them are using, like, infrared technology and GoPro-type style cameras, and they're flying over fields and making these maps that are, like, a composite of their farms or their acreage, and they're basically finding out which areas are dry, where they need to, like, fertilized in very specific ways. So they're doing these aerial scapes of their farms and acres to find out how they can better farm.
And what else are we seeing? Technology continues to be a big push. Robotics is also something that people are talking about even more and more. What are you seeing in that area at the show?
Yeah, right next to one of the drone exhibitors I was at, there is also a group that is making these, like, robotic tractors. So where they actually, like, use a drone to man this. Basically, the drone will go out and, like, map a course, and then the tractor will go out and then do all the work that the drone just told it to do. So they're actually using these two technologies together for that. And people are also really talking about, like, apps and ag. It seems like every exhibitor I talk to has an app that links their product. For example, this drone and also this tractor. They bring their composite images and their work, and it goes straight to your smartphone with all the data it collects.
Now, last year at the farm show, the drought was on everybody's mind. Governor Brown was there and made a visit and pledged some support for Valley farmers. What is the mood like when it comes to the drought at this show? Of course, the Tulare Farm Show, the World Ag Expo, is bigger than just the Valley, but many Valley farmers are there. What's the mood like when it comes to California's water situation?
Well, it seems pretty dire. I talked to one farmer yesterday who was here setting up, and he was saying that he's a well driller. That's what he does for his business. So he even makes his own style equipment for his well drilling. But he says he's here because he wants to find new technology that can help him in his well drilling business. So it feels like everyone here, at least if you're from this area or California, they're on the lookout for some way to better their farm or save some money when it comes to water.
Great. Again, stay tuned to Valley Public Radio. This week, you'll hear more reports from Ezra David Romero from the World Ag Expo in Tulare. Ezra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Joe.
Paul Betancourt is with us now, an actual farmer in our studio. He's also an author, and his new book is called This Week on the Farm. Paul, welcome.
Good morning.
I want to follow up just on what Ezra was talking about before we get to your book. Apps in ag, robotics, drones. You were nodding your head as Ezra was talking about all of those things.
I just loaded a new app in my phone last night.
Is this the world that agriculture in the 21st century in the Valley has become? Because when you drive down Highway 99 or any of the other roads in the country, it looks pretty much the same as it did 30 years ago. Maybe the crops have changed a little bit, more almonds. But there's something going on here that we don't necessarily see every day when we drive past a farm.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a piece in the book called Shovels and Cell Phones. There's shovels and smartphones. You know, Mas Masumoto takes his shovel with him when he goes on public speaking events. And, yeah, shovels are really important to us. But we also have a smartphone in the other hand. I use it to check weather. I track last weekend's storm. The app I loaded last night has marketing information as well as recent research finds. It's, you know, agronomy and weather. So he was talking about drones driving tractors. I think in a few years, I'll have Ruben driving three tractors. They'll all be run by GPS. He'll have a laptop. He'll come out in the morning, hit the commands on the laptop, pull the one in, service it while the other two drive. You know, the technology is amazing.
Now, also, before we get to the book, since you're a farmer in Kerman, you face the same challenges as farmers all across the Valley when it comes to the drought and California's situation this year. What does 2015 look like on the Betancourt farm?
It's looking a lot like 2014. We did okay, but we put $40,000 into wells last year to refurbish them and keep going. I'm going to have to put some more money in refurbishing. We put in a drip system last year. Talking with a neighbor this morning, FID, Fresno Irrigations, it's looked like we're going to get 30 days water. Well, you know, that's 1 month. We got another 11 months to farm. So we were hopeful going into the season, especially after that storm in December, we'd get some rainfall. Obviously, if it rains only every 2 months, that's not going to be nearly enough. He was talking about irrigation technology. You know, we've never had extra water, so we've always been careful with our water, and we're just getting more careful.
Moving on to this new book now that just came out, This Week on the Farm. This is not your first book.
No.
You've written several. How did this one come about? These are short essays that sort of chronicle a year or two on the farm.
They started on radio. Did a year and a half on Kino. Doing these little one-minute stories about life on the farm, and then we did them on KMJ for a while. And this is kind of compiling all those scripts together.
So where did the idea for this, not to do the book? You already had all these stories, or even the radio thing. What made you want to do something like this? You're busy. You've got a lot of different crops to farm. You grow almonds. You grow cotton. You grow all these other things. And then you're also writing these essays. Why even bother to do this?
Well, one of the pieces in there is about another endangered species, the farmer. There's just fewer and fewer of us. And came across an author years ago, and she said, you know, farmers have a great story to tell, but if they let other people tell it, you know, it's not going to get told right. And so that's how I got started with Farm Bureau, just going and visiting classrooms. And the Water District asked me to do a blog on what's happening on the farm. So that was the origin for This Week on the Farm. And it's just telling the story of what's happening here in agriculture.
Let's go ahead and maybe have you read one of the stories. We'll sort of intersperse a few questions and stories
since
in between.
There's a couple on the farm show, and since it's a farm show today, it's farm show time again, and a young farmer's thoughts turn to new toys. Okay, even old farmer's thoughts turns to new toys. The farm show is one of the first signs of spring. You know I like cooler weather, but by now most of us are thinking that's enough of that, and it's time for warming up. Here in the valley, the farm show is one of the first signs of spring. Next, the almond and fruit trees will start blooming. There's a lot of unsettled weather ahead, but the days are getting longer and spring is on the way. Farm equipment is pretty amazing. The engineers and inventors who create new farm equipment are some of the most creative problem solvers in the world, and we owe them a great deal. They've eliminated a lot of the drudge work. They've helped increase our food supply, as well as the variety of foods available to us. They are true innovators, and my hat's off to them. So it's time to head to Tulare, look at new equipment, and find some good barbecue. You don't think we just go for the tractors, do you?
Paul Bettencourt reading from his new book, This Week on the Farm. Paul is a Kerman area farmer and a former president of the Fresno County Farm Bureau. His new book is out and is a collection of short essays about life on the farm. Paul, your personal story is a little different than many of your peers. You didn't grow up on the farm. You grew up in Southern California and wound up here. Was that a challenge adjusting to a new lifestyle and maybe adjusting to your neighbors and maybe your neighbors adjusting to you? Did they look at you differently as, you know, this guy from San Diego?
Actually, my neighbors are pretty awesome. They welcomed me in and helped me learn. Because when I came here in 81, agriculture was changing and going through a lot of change, so I learned alongside them. So the neighbors were pretty welcoming. Change in culture, you know, growing up in suburban San Diego and coming up here, their only real tough adjustment was July. It's just too hot. But other than that, it's been fabulous.
You grow almonds, and almonds have been a subject of a lot of attention in the media this year. There's an op-ed, or actually an editorial, that the Sacramento Bee published this week and announced in the Fresno Bee talking about the California almond industry, and the Bee is going to be doing a lot of extensive coverage on it over the next year. They look at some of the other media attention that almonds have received and say it's kind of gotten a bad rap. What do you think about the way that people talk about what you do, the almond industry? When you read something that says, like I believe it was The Atlantic that called the almonds the demon nut. And this is, again, due to the amount of acreage that's been planted, the boom in exports of almonds outside of the U.S., and the amount of water that it takes to grow this
crop. It's not a boom of exports. We always exported 85% of our almonds. So that's just
– the percentage hasn't changed, but the volume has
– absolutely. You know, it's kind of one of it's the dissonance. You hear a lot of criticism of agriculture and what we do, and that's fine. Nothing I do is above question. But, you know, when food leaves the farm, it's healthy, it's good, it's nutritious. What happens to it afterwards, you know, you take a potato and turn it into a potato chip and it's not health food anymore. And we do need to look at, you know, things like use of resources like water. And that's part of the conversation. That's why I've written the book. That's why I appreciate the time to come in and share the book. That's why I post a blog weekly. You'll be part of that conversation. I think we've got a great story to tell. And it's surprising to see the dissonance, you know. I mean, we're growing a healthy product like almonds. You know, the nutrition data is there. The health benefits are there. And then it's called the demon nut. There's a little bit of dissonance on that.
If you look at the growth trend in almond acreage, it's pretty steep growth curve.
Sure.
At some point, that has to level off, because if you continue that growing out, pretty soon the entire valley will be nothing but almonds.
Well, but here's the irony.
Do you see that changing?
25 years ago, the price of almonds had gone to $1 a pound. We were growing 500 million pounds, and everybody's wondering, when is the market going to collapse? Now we're growing a 2 billion pound crop, and the price is over $3 a pound. And obviously, the marketing guys have been doing a good job. There's demand for the product, and it's being driven by market. When there's no more demand for the product goes away. But we grow a world-class nut. You know, in the book, I tell the story of being in a cafe in Italy, and they brought out, you know, I got my coffee, and they bring out this little copper ash. It looked like an ashtray with some burnt stuff in it. And I realized after a while there were roasted pistachios in there, but they were burnt little nubbins, like they looked about the size of a pencil eraser. They wouldn't know what to do with a full-size green California pistachio. And there's demand for our products all over the world, and that's a good thing. It's one of the things we do well here in California.
There's also criticism of some growers, especially in areas outside of maybe where you grow, mm-hmm. that have planted almond orchards without even really a backup source of water, without something to fall back on. What do you think about that?
I'm left scratching my head. You know, I've got neighbors in Kerman with vines that never put in a well. And these short years, they're scrambling trying to – I have no idea how somebody makes that investment. You're making a 30-year investment and you have no secure supply of water. That's crazy.
But along those lines with the concerns about water, we have these new groundwater regulations that are being implemented right now. They mm-hmm. are not in effect in their entirety yet. Mm-hmm. Agencies are being developed. Plans are being developed as we speak. Earlier this year, we had Ryan Jacobson and Tricia Stever-Blattler from Tulare County mm-hmm. on this program from Fresno County Farm mm-hmm. Bureau in Tulare County. And they talked about not just the concern farmers have about the new groundwater regulations, but also they said farmers, in their view, see it as an opportunity. What do you think about these new regulations and what does it mean for your operation?
I'm concerned about how the regs are going to come down. I did a piece for the Business Journal last summer, Death of a Family Farm. I don't know how our farm, and the family's been farming for over 100 years, my wife's family, and I don't know how we survived 2020. Because the air district's going to have us buy all new tractors, and that's $750,000. My pockets aren't that deep, and the state's going to say you can't pump water. You know, and what do I do in a dry year to pay the bills for the new tractors? I don't know how we survive. I hope it's an opportunity, but right now I see it as a fairly significant threat.
But isn't that same threat also there on the other side, that how long does that well last? How long can you continue to pump?
Actually, we've documented. I've got a well that's up 60 feet in the last 5 years, and that surprised us. And the only reason I can figure is there's been so much ground fallowed around us that it's allowed the groundwater underneath that well to recharge. So that might be what happens is, you know, there's going to be enough ground fallowed that, you know, we measure. And that's in the groundwater regs, you know, we're going to measure and come up with a plan. I hope it doesn't eliminate agriculture, but yeah, it does make it more sustainable. You know, obviously, overdrafting the groundwater is a dumb idea. Yeah. So we'll see how it works.
Let's hear another short story from your new book. Again, Paul Bettencourt, This Week on the Farm is his new collection of essays about life on a Kerman area farm. It's based on a blog that he's written and also a radio series that he's done. Paul, one do you have?
The people in agriculture, something special. I'm a better man because I knew Horace Boyd. Horace was a ranch foreman when I came up here, but he came much more than a boss. He was a mentor, a tutor, and a guide as I started learning about farming. He and his wife, Frances, became adopted grandparents to our kids. I fondly remember fishing with Horace and my kids. That guy sure loved to go fishing. He would get as excited as Heidi and Jonathan when he caught a fish. It may seem a little strange, but one of the most important lessons he taught me was not about the soil, crops, or tractors. Of course he taught me about those. One of the most important lessons Horace taught me was how to treat vendors, the people who provide goods and services we use on the farm. They're used to being treated as cogs on the wheel. And Horace taught me, if you have a rush item and you come in, you tell them it's a rush item, pick it up when they say it's going to be ready, because if you don't, your next rush order is going to be really, really late. Like I said, this may sound like an odd lesson for a farmer, but when I watch how some of my neighbors treat the mechanics and welders we rely on, I can see his point. You can see how Horace was a friend to everyone, and I'm a better man because I knew Horace.
Paul Bettencourt reading from his book, This Week on the Farm. Paul, where can people find the book?
Currently stocked at the Clovis Book Barn. It's on Amazon.com. We're working on Barnes & Noble and Costco, but we don't have a final decision out of them.
Great. Again, it's a new book, a collection of short stories, short essays about life on a farm. And maybe one more, Paul, before we go. If you can find one more to share with our listeners.
Another one about people. We've all heard about what's wrong with teenagers these days. Let me introduce you to some of the best kids out there, the future farmers of America. These young men and women are some of the brightest, poised, and well-spoken young people in our society. I'm always encouraged when I'm around them. They are so energetic. You may have seen them at the fair with their blue jackets. In addition to their regular classes during their high school years, they prepare and compete in fields such as livestock, ag mechanics, agronomy, ornamental horticulture. I don't know how many of them will actually farm in the future. Actually, farmers are becoming an endangered species. But they have learned the lessons of farming. Hard work is important, but it takes smart work too. An old friend told me years ago, you can't outsmart a smart farmer. The young men and women of FFA will be hard to outsmart wherever they end up because of what they've learned during their years in the future farmers of America.
Paul Bettencourt reading from his book, This Week on the Farm. You can find it at the Book Barn in Clovis, also on Amazon. Paul, a Kerman area farmer, joining us today on Valley Edition. Thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoy some of the barbecue down at the farm show.
Thanks. Appreciate your interest.
Stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and talk to the director of the brand new Kevin Costner motion picture, McFarland USA. We'll find out why this all-American success story has captivated audiences nationwide. It's had its premiere last night in Hollywood. We'll talk to the director coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. Listening to Valley Edition. It's just 129 miles from the star-lined sidewalks of Hollywood Boulevard to the dusty streets of McFarland, California, in rural Kern County. On the surface, it might be hard to think of two parts of the Golden State that could possibly be more different. But last night, when a major motion picture based on the real-life story of the McFarland High School cross-country team and coach Jim White premiered at the El Capitan Theater, the two are now linked for good. The film is called McFarland USA. It stars Kevin Costner as the coach who came to the poor, largely Latino community of farm laborers just north of Bakersfield and helped his students become legends in the world of high school athletics, eventually winning a state record 9 championships in a row.
Cross-country running. California is holding their first state championship this year.
You do understand we don't have a cross-country team?
Yep.
You've coached cross-country before?
No.
You competed in high school, maybe?
No.
Well, you sound perfect.
Just try and remember, lowest score wins.
Like off.
We don't got a country club. We don't even got a Kmart.
Didn't know McFarland had a team.
Fourth place, that's not too shabby.
Fourth out of four, also known as last.
Better luck next time, boys.
This is gonna come down to which runners can handle the pain.
Let's hit it again.
Mr. White, each hour that my boys train with you, they do not work with me. That's food off our table.
No one stays in McFarland unless they have to.
There ain't nothing American dream about this place.
I'm guessing running's the best thing you've got. Me too.
The Disney film hits screens nationwide later this month. We're joined now by the director, Nikki Caro. Nikki, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
It may be a long way from Hollywood to McFarland, but it's even a longer journey from New Zealand to McFarland. What attracted you to this script, and how did you first learn about it?
I was inspired. That's what attracted me. I learned about it when I was being considered for another project at Disney, and Disney felt that I would be suited to this kind of material. And I was just so inspired, not just by Jim White and what he and his team achieved, but equally inspired by the people themselves, the people of the Central Valley.
You've said that you had Kevin Costner in mind all along for this role. What do you think, or why do you think he was the ideal actor to play Coach Jim White?
Nobody has a more impeccable pedigree in sports dramas than Kevin Costner. For that reason alone, we were really desperate to have him in this movie. And now having worked with him, I can't imagine anybody else would have come to it with the same sense of generosity and enthusiasm. He's a wonderful, I mean, obviously a very, very highly skilled and gifted actor, but also a wonderful human being, and he gave so generously of himself to those boys, to me, and to the production. And I'm really, really proud of the work that he did in the film and the work that we all did together.
Was it a tough sell to get him? I understand he actually had a personal connection to McFarland. He grew up, or at least spent some time in the Central Valley growing up in Visalia.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's always interesting when you have those initial conversations with actors and you wonder where is the common ground going to be? And I didn't realize that the common ground was the ground. You know, he spent his childhood up there and has an intimate knowledge of what that life is like. So we began working together pretty far down the road because we had that shared understanding of what this movie was about.
Talking about Kevin Costner, of course, in this film, but the real stars, you could say, are the student athletes that are in the film. Tell me about how you selected some of the actors to play those students. I understand some of them actually came from the McFarland area.
Yeah, roughly, well, three of them are from McFarland itself. We did a huge search in an open call in Bakersfield, in Los Angeles, San Diego, Texas, because there's not a deep pool of young Hispanic actors or Mexican actors that are gifted runners. That pool is very shallow. So we went through a lot of open calls, and amazingly enough, three of the kids we found were from McFarland itself. And the team is roughly split in half between kids that can run but couldn't act, and kids that could act but couldn't run. So we put them through rigorous training, both athletic and dramatic. And over the course of those months where those boys were getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and running and going to the gym and eating together and training together and working together on all the dramatic requirements of the movie, they literally became a team, and they're very, very close now. I think they'll be close for the rest of their lives.
In talking about this film, this is not just a movie about the Central Valley. It's a movie, it's a sports movie. It's also a movie about race. There's a line in the film where one of the students says, "There's nothing American dream about this place," talking about McFarland, this community that's struggling with poverty and largely home to immigrants who've come to work in the fields. But by the end of the film, though, I think people might have a different view of McFarland, and specifically that thought about the American dream. What do you think this story says about that very issue, the American dream and an immigrant community like we saw here?
Yeah. Well, my big thought is that this is a profoundly American film. It so happens that 99% of the people in the film are Mexican, but it's a profoundly American story. It's an underdog story, and it's a feel-good film for sure, because when these underdogs succeed, it feels so good. But this is, this is a film that speaks very loudly about all American values, about faith and family and community and achieving something beyond expectations. And, you know, those, I love the idea that those are not only, they're not uniquely American values. They are, in fact, the values dearly held by a lot of immigrant communities, and especially the Latin communities.
We're talking with director Nikki Caro. She is the director of the new film McFarland USA. It debuts nationwide February 20th. It just held its premiere in Hollywood last night. Nikki, what's your favorite scene in the film?
Oh, don't.
Or maybe your favorite.
I like most of them. To be brutally honest, I really, really do.
Or maybe your favorite memory from production.
But there is a scene. It's a tiny, tiny little scene in the middle of the movie, and all that happens is a bus carrying these kids drives through town to go to a big cross-country meet. And for me, that's the moment of the film, and it's very personal, that I feel is it captures emotionally exactly what is going on, which is that, and I had written a line in the script that these kids, the kids in the bus, felt like heroes for the first time in their lives. And on the outside, they go past the market, and there's little kids have made signs, and they chase the bus. And it's a very sweet scene about what it means to a small town when their own start to achieve. It's lovely.
Did you ever have a chance to talk with the real Jim White?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Very first thing I did when I came aboard the movie was to go up there. And, in fact, I stayed with Jim and his wife, Cheryl, in their house. And they took me all around. And I got to experience McFarland in the most intimate way possible. It was a wonderful way to begin.
What did you take away from that experience going there for the first time? What do you remember from that trip?
I remember when the sun started to go down, because, of course, it's very, very hot there, as you know. But when the sun starts to go down, the runners start to come out. And it's amazing. You drive around McFarland at 5 o'clock in the evening, and you see packs of teenage kids running, girls and boys. And they are so strong and so fast and so beautiful, and the dust kicks up off their heels, and, of course, it's all backlit by the setting sun. It was incredibly cinematic and incredibly beautiful, and I guess at that point I thought that something really special could be made from the material, but it was something that wasn't like a movie construct. It was something that was totally real, and what this movie does is light up McFarland, and it lights up every community like McFarland, and there are thousands of them. And I hope that people in the Central Valley, or you know, people anywhere that come from similar place, can see how beautiful it is, and they are.
You mentioned that scene and thinking of the cinematography of it. Let's talk about the production of the film and the cinematography of it. You really capture some beautiful moments there. What are you most proud of in working with your team? And talk about the production of the film if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I guess overall I'm most proud of how authentic the movie is and how specific it is. We worked very, very hard to achieve that. But as a filmmaker, the biggest thrill for me was to shoot in the Californian landscape. And of course, you shoot in cross-country means you're not watching kids go round and round a track. You can actually take them to some pretty astonishing environments. And we did. And it's so thrilling because people don't shoot in California so much anymore. You know, there are other cheaper places to shoot. So movies inevitably go where the tax incentives are. But Disney's commitment to honoring the authenticity and specificity of this story meant that we were based in California. And so I got to take those kids to run in some absolutely beautiful places and create some images, I think, that people haven't seen before.
There's a lot of talk in the industry right now about race, about reaching Latino audiences. How do you feel this film will help connect with that community?
Well, it was incredibly important to me that it does. So when I'm making the film, certainly when I'm editing the film, I screen a lot and for as many Mexican people as I could convince to come and be part of my process. And so I'm very, very aware and alive to their opinion of the movie. And so when we started to screen and I could see it connecting, it gave me a lot of confidence, a lot of relief too, to be very honest. And so I love to watch the movie with a Hispanic audience, or a predominantly Hispanic audience, because they get all the jokes, and I find it it's kind of a joyous, you know, it's a feel good movie, but with them it feels really good, and I really hope the Latin an audience can come out and see what it's all about.
The film is called McFarland USA. It premieres nationwide February 20th. It tells the story of the remarkable McFarland High School cross-country team and Coach Jim White, who led his students to a state record 9 championships in a row. We've been talking with director Nikki Caro, who's behind the film and, again, stars Kevin Costner and others. Ms. Caro, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Music connects people with the deepest part of their being, both for the young and the old, bringing joy and many other benefits. On this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Kay Bonner Cummings of the Bonner Family Foundation of Fresno champions music for every age and generation.
An October 2014 Wall Street Journal essay cited research that showed the power of music training to boost IQ, focus, and persistence among school children. Even compared with other art forms, music training for young children produced markedly better classroom results in processing sound, reading, and focus. At the high school level, the impact of music training trumps all other art forms in producing high academic results and satisfaction. A few years ago, I asked members of a high school choir to put in writing why music and choir were important to them. These were some of their answers. Music to me is life, my reason for living, a reason to go to school, the reason many people stay in school. It has given me the opportunity to work with others to produce something beautiful, and I feel extremely sorry for anyone who has not experienced something like that. I've made some of my best friends in choir. We care for each other and have one common bond, music. If there were no music in schools, life would have no meaning. I'd die of boredom. Music and choir excite me, give me energy, make me happy when I'm sad. I would be completely lost without it. My life would be horrible. It helps me think. I breathe, live, and love music. Without it in the schools, this world would be gray. With music, everything comes to life. Two students, both on suicide watch, spoke of the choir as having saved their lives. Several spoke of better attendance and improved grades. It taught them teamwork, being responsible and confident, all important life skills. And one, in considering others, wrote, "It brings joy into other people's lives." Still, music and other art programs continue to take a back seat or be downright expendable. Why? Why not listen to the students? It's their education. And at the other end of one's life is also proof of the power of music. The recent award-winning documentary, Alive Inside, A Story of Music and Memory, tells of dementia and Alzheimer patients in nursing homes, exhibiting how music brings them out of their isolation. Dan Cohen, founder of Music and Memory, maintains that music connects people with who they have been and who they are in their life. He brings iPods into nursing homes and puts on the patient's favorite music for individual listening. The response has been overwhelming. The patients quite literally come alive, sing along, cry with joy, and in many cases, return to being themselves by bringing back old memories. One doctor cited the healthcare system as a model too focused on administering drugs, when what's needed is to touch the heart and soul of people. No pill does what music does, he maintains. In conclusion, at every age, music is powerful. For The Moral Is, this is Kay Cummings.
The Moral is a production of the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State and Valley Public Radio. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the center or the station. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. Speaking of the world of music, this Sunday the stage of the William Saroyan Theater in Fresno comes alive as the Fresno Grand Opera's production of Andre Previn's A Streetcar Named Desire takes the stage. It's not just a great chance to hear world-class musicians, though. It's also a big moment for the company as it enters a new era. Last year, the Fresno Grand Opera and the Townsend Opera in Modesto joined forces in a partnership that, at least in Central California, is unprecedented. Here to tell us more is Matthew Buckman, the Fresno Grand Opera's new general director. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start out and talk about what changes have happened with the company before we get to A Streetcar Named Desire. You have this partnership now between two opera organizations in different parts of the valley. How did this come about, and what exactly does this involve?
Sure. Well, you know, I think arts organizations over the last 5 to 6 years have really had to re-examine their business models with the economic crash that we had. And it makes organizations stop and look at how can we do things differently and make ourselves more sustainable, because I think the biggest lesson that we learned is ultimately we operate at the whim of the patron base, and sometimes that goes up and sometimes that goes down. So for us, the key thing was sustainability, and with Fresno being so close to Modesto and vice versa, we thought this would be a good opportunity to partner and really make organizations more sustainable. So we had a season in Modesto ready to go. We got together with Fresno and decided we would co-produce the current season that we're in, and those decisions were made this past summer, and that grew into a request by the board of Fresno Grand Opera for me to come in as the new general director.
So you have two organizations that are still, at least at some level, separate organizations, but they're sharing the production season and also the operations. Is that
to some degree, yes. Mainly we're co-producing seasons together. That's the nature of the relationship. The two organizations will remain independent of one another. But with having this full kind of creative and management partnership with one leader at the helm of both organizations, it allows for future planning with some stability. And we know that partnership's going to be there several years down the road and can start planning projects, because unfortunately the opera world does work 2 to 3 years in advance. And so by having the same leadership of both organizations, we're able to plan that far out and know that that relationship will continue to exist.
So this also means that in the case of A Streetcar Named Desire, which is in Fresno, mm-hmm. it was recently in Modesto as well.
That's correct. Yeah, and it's you know, it's really great to have more time to work on these shows. And so with the two organizations sharing budgets and those kinds of things, we give ourselves more time to prepare. A better quality product hits our stage, and for the Fresno audience, they're getting it you know, after a couple of performances in Modesto. So it really will be a fantastic performance.
Tell us a little more about the Townsend Opera for our listeners mm-hmm. in Fresno, Madera, Merced counties who maybe aren't familiar with what Townsend Opera has done. What's its history and what's your history with the organization?
Absolutely. You know, I came to the organization 7 years ago and replaced the founder of the company, who at the time was unfortunately dying of lung cancer. And you know, I started in February of 2008, which was a fascinating time in the business world and in the arts world. And we also had a brand new performing arts venue that had opened up that year as well.
The Gallo Center.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Exactly.
Beautiful facility.
It really is. And so we hit the three things that can challenge an organization's existence, any one of these three things, and we hit it all three at the same time. We lost our founder. We moved into a new, much higher-end performing arts venue. And the economy collapsed. So we worked through that for a couple of years. And then once the organization became a little bit more stable, we focused on what we call the Opera Remix Initiative, which is how do we re-engage opera with a 21st century audience. And that really has defined my work there in the last 4 years. And the production that we had this weekend of A Streetcar Named Desire is kind of the culmination of 4 years of work to try to re-engage what is really an antiquated art form with modern culture, so that it has a place in our future culture.
Now let's talk about your vision along mm-hmm. those lines, your vision for the companies moving forward. Over the last few years, I've heard criticism in the community of the Fresno Grand Opera saying they aren't doing enough of the traditional yeah. operas. We want La Boheme. We mm-hmm. want you know, the famous operas that we've come to know and love. And we've seen more forays into more pop mm-hmm. types of things. How do you fall on that spectrum, as you know, maintaining the financial viability of companies is also paramount, because without that, you don't have the opportunity to even do those other works.
Absolutely. You know, I actually look a little farther back. I think all the criticisms we hear, all the decisions we made are actually symptoms of a larger problem, which is the art form is disconnected from our culture. And so people who want to see opera, and they define opera very narrowly as 19th century repertoire, so music that was written in the 1800s. We kind of define opera now as something that happened a really, really long time ago, and we want to keep recreating that. And the longer we do that, the more it disconnects from modern culture. And so I think you've seen Fresno Grand Opera over the last 5 or 6 years confront the reality that the audience for very traditional opera, 19th century opera, is very small and can't sustain an organization. And so it's made forays into different kinds of repertoire to try to address the issue of sustainability. Where I fall in this is I think actually that's a false dichotomy, that you don't have to present opera defined narrowly as 19th century opera or Broadway musicals or, you know, Evola or popular repertoire. That's a false dichotomy in my mind. There's a lot of music being written in the last 20, 30 years, great American operas, music that is easily hummed, melodic, you know, tonal, very, very enjoyable to listen to. Pieces have been written in the last 20, 30 years about American stories, that tell American stories by American composers, sung in English, all these kinds of things, but are written as operas, and they really are truly operas. And you're seeing our industry realize that this repertoire really should have a place at the opera house and should be the channel by which we reconnect the art form to an American culture.
And speaking of contemporary American operas, Andre Previn's Streetcar Named Desire is a perfect example of that. Tell us about this production that's coming up Sunday.
It's really the crowning achievement in my career at this point, I'll be quite honest. I'm really excited about it because it, first of all, is one of the great American plays. It redefined American theater, stage theater, mid-20th century. And to have it set to music, I think, is unbelievable. The role of Blanche DuBois, sung by Carrie Hennessy in this production, is the iconic American role, really, on the stage. And to see it come to life set to music is just really remarkable. It's a very difficult story, but I think very convincingly told by the music. There are 5 or 6 arias in the show that are just some of the most beautiful music I think you can hear. But it also recontextualizes opera. I mean, operas at the end of the day are stories set to music. And with Streetcar in particular, because the estate of Tennessee Williams didn't allow for the words to be changed at all, the music really, I feel, supports the story. And so you almost get a play that is set to music instead of the kind of operatic experience you expect to hear with a Bohème or another Puccini or Verdi opera. So it recontextualizes opera, but it still tells a really, really powerful story.
Now, this is the same cast that you had in Modesto.
That's correct.
Us briefly about them. We only have a minute or so left.
Absolutely. Carrie Hennessy is the soprano singing the role of Blanche. We decided to do Streetcar in tandem with Carrie because she's one of the finest singing actresses I've ever seen in my career, and she's quite remarkable in this role. Dan Kempson singing the iconic role of Stanley Kowalski, made famous by Marlon Brando, recently nominated for a Grammy, sung at the Metropolitan Opera, one of the finest young singers I've heard in a while. He's 29 years old and is already singing at the Met. And Kira Duffy is a marvelous soprano who has sung with the Metropolitan Opera and with LA Opera, I believe, singing Stella. I think the really neat thing about this production is we got Brad Dalton, who is the preeminent director for this piece, to come in and serve as a stage director for this. So he directed Renee Fleming's productions at Washington National Opera, Chicago Lyric Opera, and LA Opera just in the last 18 months. So to have him in our organizations working with us is really a boon for our communities.
If people are looking forward to this weekend, maybe Valentine's Day plans, what should they do? Where can they get information about this production?
Yeah, absolutely. Visit us at FresnoGrandOpera.org. You'll see the link to Streetcar right there on the homepage. I'm really excited to announce that we want opera to be more accessible, and so we have readjusted some of our ticket pricing and opened up some different areas in the hall to be a little bit more accessible. And so our tickets actually only start at $10, and this will be an ongoing thing now. So all of our main stage productions, tickets start at $10. So there's not a financial reason to not be able to go to the opera. It's an amazing experience. This piece and this story is quite compelling. It's, you know, it's dark, it's a little bit down, but it's still, I think, one of the finest pieces of acting and singing you'll see in our community this year, and you can get it for $10.
And you mentioned that opera works about 3 years out. I imagine there will be an announcement at some point in the relatively near future about the next season?
That's correct.
All right. We'll be looking forward to that. Again, Matthew Buckman, the new general director for the Fresno Grand Opera and general director of the Townsend Sounds and Opera in Modesto. The two companies have joined forces now and are producing, again, A Streetcar Named Desire this Sunday at the Sororian Theater. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter. We're @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.